On occasion, I'd pick up Tower Records' free in-house magazine, Pulse, and flip through it in the bathroom. One of the best things about it was that they printed lists of desert island discs from readers, those mythical 10 records you take with you if you knew you were going to be stranded on a desert island with nothing but a stereo, plentiful and varied food, and naked island babes who worshipped you as a god. Whoops, wrong fantasy. It was always entertaining seeing what people would put down. Most of them kept to the rules, but you did have the occasional scofflaw who decided that the entire recorded output of Pink Floyd should really only count as one record. Or he'd keep it to 10, and yes, it was almost always a he, and then throw in his entire tape collection. Only 10 records, though. I also liked seeing not only how narrow some people's tastes were, but how proud of those narrow tastes they were. People who put 9 Rolling Stones records on their list and then stretched out at number 10 with something from Keith Richards' solo project. Or people who put something on their list that's been out for a month. Sure, they like it now. For years, I tried to figure out what 10 records I would take to a desert island. I rarely finished a list, but I loved working on it and seeing how things had shifted since the last time I had done it. There were a couple of records that always made the list. The first Cars album, Thomas Dolby's original release of the Golden Age of the Wireless. Peter Gabriel's Security were pretty much guaranteed to show up on the list somewhere, usually near the top. The other album that always made the list, and still would today, was David Byrne and Brian Eno's landmark 1981 collaboration, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. Like many of my favorite records, I didn't particularly like Bush of Ghosts when I first heard it. And I first heard it in a dance studio. When I was a junior at Interlochen, one of our guest dance teachers was this guy named Jeff from something called the Ozone Dance Theater. He blew into the dance department that spring like a breath of fresh pot smoke. Voidness is like avoiding a plague. We cannot He was eccentric, to put it charitably, and his reputation as that weird stone guy quickly spread across campus. He talked extremely quietly and said things that didn't make sense even when you did hear them, loved to spin in circles, and was seen walking backwards through the woods on more than one occasion. But he had great taste in music and strange ideas in choreography. His contribution to the Spring Dance Concert was a wild, ambitious piece. At one point, it was nearly an hour long and incorporated 10 different pieces of music, but was eventually whittled down to 4 pieces, lasting just over 15 minutes. Each chunk of the piece was built from some chance element, either something formal like the I Ching or something more casual like dancer improvisations. The ultimate piece was performed with all of the dancers, probably around 30, wearing all black except for white tennis shoes. Almost all of the dancers were on stage all of the time, performing complex patterns of repeated movements, or jumping up and down for several minutes at a time, or walking as slowly as possible across the stage. While all this was going on, a series of slides was projected around the stage and on the walls of the auditorium. It was all very avant-garde and was called Yeshi. The local paper, the Traverse City Record Eagle, or the Tragic, Shitty, Wretched Beagle, as it was not so affectionately known, came to write an article about the performance, and I was sitting in the auditorium behind Jeff when he was being interviewed. The reporter asked him the name of his piece, and Jeff said, "It's called Yeshi, with a small y." Sure enough, the next day's paper proudly announced his piece as Yeshi with a small y, all capitalized. Ah, the wretched beagle. The final version of Yeshi with a small y included music by Kraftwerk, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, and opened with the first two tracks from Brian Eno and David Byrne's My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. It's safe to say that I had never heard music like this, but at that time, neither had anybody else. and it was about to set off an explosion. Like much of the music that will accompany me to that sandy isle, my life in the Bush of Ghosts didn't immediately captivate me. This is significant. Much of the music that appeals to me right away wears its welcome out pretty quickly. Sure, I couldn't get enough of Jay Giles' Love Stinks for a couple of weeks there, wearing through the vinyl, but once those 2 weeks were up, I never pulled the single out again. Songs like that, that appeal to me instantly, that I get right away, don't hold much long-term interest for me because they don't teach me anything new. The very thing that makes them immediately captivating, their familiarity, is what bores me after a short while. He's got his arm around every man. There are, of course, exceptions, such as Fountains of Wayne, who regurgitate and recombine the past 50 years' worth of pop music into their maddeningly catchy tunes and still remain vitally interesting to me. Baby, please, leave the biker, break his heart. Baby, please, leave the biker, break his heart. The biker, leave the biker, break his heart. But generally speaking, it's the music that makes my brain grow new dendrites that ultimately sticks with me the longest. It's the challenge of the unfamiliar, of incorporating new musical vocabulary, that makes listening to new music so exciting for me. A lot of people don't feel this way. My wife, for one, would rather hear something she knows than something she doesn't know, but I just make sure I play enough new stuff around her that the unfamiliar becomes familiar, and then she has a lot more stuff she knows to choose from. Many people find a kind of music they like and never stray from it, listening to the same records they listened to in college for the rest of their lives, the Big Chill effect, but that's not me. I love a bit of musical nostalgia and will wallow for weeks at a time in the warm waters of old favorites, but I'm always willing to jump into the icy sea of unfamiliarity, and I hope I always shall be. Producer extraordinaire Brian Eno had hooked up with Talking Heads early in their career and became their producer of choice after working on their second album, More Songs About Buildings and Food. Eno and Talking Heads vocalist and presumed leader David Byrne seemed to hit it off especially well. Talking Heads' third album, fear of music, continued the productive collaboration between the band and Eno, and included one small track that would signal a radical change in the group's direction and change the course of popular music. That track was E-Zimbra, and it sounded out of place on the album. Fear of Music is filled with traditional songs that sound like they were played by a traditional rock band. Here's the rhythm section, here's the guitars, here's the verses and chorus, here's the solo, and so on. Basic rock form 101. E-Zimbra, on the other hand, sounds positively African, at least to Western ears. The rhythms are much more complicated, and what's more, everybody seems to be playing them. The drum and bass are playing rhythm parts, sure, but so are the guitars. There doesn't seem to be any lead in the song. Even the vocals are more of a rhythmic element than a focal point. The whole structure of the song is different, focusing on the way the different parts fit together rather than creating space for alternating solos. The band was exhilarated by this approach and adopted it completely for the next album, the sublime, trend-setting Remain in Light. Instead of four musicians, the band swelled to 11. Songs were built up carefully using overlapping rhythmic elements. Nobody had the lead, nobody played support, all musicians were equal in this new musical paradigm. Sometimes the world has a load of questions. Seems like the world knows nothing at all. The world is near, but it's out of reach. Some people touch it, but they can't hold on. Most American popular music is based more on competition rather than collaboration. Who can play the loudest solo? Who can grab the most attention? Who can play the most notes? This music was much more democratic than that, and showed a model of a different way that society could be organized. Highly intellectual concepts, to be sure, but they were just what the moment needed. Lost my shape. We'll be right back. Suddenly, everybody was turning to Africa for inspiration. Surely some were doing it to add a taste of the newest flavor to their project, but some, I believe, like Peter Gabriel, like Martha and the Muffins, perhaps even Paul Simon, although I'm somewhat skeptical of his motives, were doing it really to try out a new social order. It sounds revolutionary, and it is. Unfortunately, music in this culture is seen as a detachable part of society, something different and separate from the daily concerns of life. Nobody's going to listen to this music, hear that it's structured in a much more democratic way, and decide to change their life and the life of those around them based on this new, appealing structure. Still, it was the idealism of this music that was exhilarating at the time. Every generation thinks they can save the world with their music. And for me and my generation, the great polyrhythmic experimentation of the early 1980s was our bid for making the world a better place. After the balloon pops and the dust clears, each generation fails to change the world with their music, but they're all able to add something positive to the culture. And today's blossoming of interest in the music of other cultures and in the kind of cross-pollinization experiments that are going on between radical different musical idioms can, I believe, be traced back to the early 80s and Brian Eno's work with Talking Heads. Not that there weren't some problems. Ironically enough, it's just at the point where Talking Heads became more socially idealistic that the band started pulling apart. The traditional rhythm section, bassist Tina Weymouth and her husband, drummer Chris France, resented the way Eno and Byrne used the band as their own private musical laboratory, and, especially, how reluctant producer Eno was to put anything in that he felt was too poppy. God forbid we should be popular, thought Chris and Tina, and they splintered off to form Tom Tom Club, a band based on a lot of the same communal principles that Talking Heads was dealing with, but with a decidedly less intellectual, more populist agenda. Stepping in a rhythm to a Curtis blow. Who needs to think when your feet just go? With a hippie there, with a hippie there. Who needs to think when your feet just go? Behind, 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 behind. Who needs to think when your feet just go? Behind, 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 behind. James Brown. James Brown. Eno and Byrne also took their ideas and a few trusted musicians and a lot of unusual source material into the studio and created My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, which was recorded before Remain in Light, but released later. All of the songs were built up by weaving together complicated layers of rhythmic elements and unusual sonic treatments. To give the songs a voice, they pieced together bits of old radio broadcasts and tapes of Algerians singing the Quran, and exorcisms and sermons, and played them against their dense rhythmic jams. The result is like listening to the world crossbreed through a faulty shortwave radio. The music is dense and foreboding, and contemplative and jarring, and exhilarating and frightening all at once. It sounded like the future in 1981, and it still sounds like it today. Named after a really, really strange book by African writer Amos Tutuola, the album itself is A Bush of Ghosts. Deep, exotic, foreboding textures that pull you into the heart of darkness while strange disembodied voices swirl around you. I made the mistake of listening to this album on a Walkman while walking through the woods in the middle of the night, stoned. Not the best idea. I once lent the album to Andrew, a friend who lived on a different hall of my dorm in high school. He came pounding on my door half an hour later, pale and shaky. He had gotten to the end of side one and started getting really creeped out by the last track, The Jezebel Spirit. He looked at the album and read that the stolen vocal was from an exorcism and bolted out of his room, begging me not to leave him alone and to come and get my record. An extreme reaction, to be sure, but one that pays tribute to the emotional power of this album. Jezebel, spirit of destruction, spirit of grief, I bind you with chains of iron. I bind you here and let me bound in heaven. Loosen your hold and come out of her now. Start blowing out, sister. Out. Out, Jezebel, come out now. Go ahead. Out in the name of Jesus. Come out, destruction. Thank you. I would even venture to say that My Life in the Bush of Ghosts is a perfect album. There's not one track that is anything but exemplary. It's a beautiful, exhilarating, endlessly fascinating album. It's as big and mysterious and comforting and frightening as the whole wide planet. It is the sound of the distant past merging with the right now, blurring into the eternal future. It is a haunted land, a forgotten totem, a sliver of eternity. It is David Byrne and Brian Eno's My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, and it is quite possibly the finest album ever made.